Please be seated. We welcome you all. We welcome you all to the courtroom this morning, but especially welcome our students from Lakeland Union High School. Would they please stand? Good morning, and thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If they come, they are sent materials about the case. They may engage in some activities relating to that case. They continue to listen to the case, and then at noon, a justice is assigned to meet with the students in order to discuss the procedures of the court in taking and deciding cases, not the substantive issues of the case. And everyone is invited to join the students at noon. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will meet with the students today to discuss the procedures of the court. To my left is Justice Patrick Brooks. To his left is Justice Patience Robinsack, and to her left is Justice Michael Gableman. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will ask, would anyone like a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you the summary. Okay, we may proceed. I'll call the first case for today, 10-AP-557-CR, State versus Joseph C. Miller. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Miller is Martha K. Askins.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Martha Askins, and I represent Joseph Miller. In this appeal, the trial court denied my client's motion to suppress evidence found as a result of the stop of the car he was driving. The Court of Appeals affirmed. The issue before the court is whether the information possessed by the police, chiefly tips and not police investigation, constituted reasonable suspicion justifying the stop. I'm asking the court to conclude that tips that are incorrect must be negatively considered as part of the totality of the circumstances. And where is here, a confidential informant provides information that is incorrect, combined with information that is of little to no value because it simply provides identifying information rather than information demonstrating inside knowledge of illegal activities, there is no reasonable suspicion to warrant a stop. In short, a rumor that is repeated does not assume the mantle of reliability by virtue of its repetition. Reasonable suspicion must be based on specific and articulable facts. Facts, not rumors. Now, because the Fourth Amendment cases turn on facts, I'll begin with a brief summary of those relevant to this appeal. We're dealing with three tips. And the first tip I'll refer to as Mr. Manicor. Manicor was the jail inmate facing revocation, contacted Berlin, a deputy to give him some information about drug dealing. This was some 10 months before the stop in this case. He says Miller lives on Water Street, says he drives a blue and silver Chevy truck, says a dealer comes from Milwaukee and sells drugs to Miller, and Manicor has no prior track record of providing correct information to the police. Then we have the Crime Stoppers. There are three tips there. They're anonymous calls. They're not recorded. Berlin doesn't speak to those individuals. One tip says Miller lives in a trailer park behind the Domino's. One says he lives on Terrace Avenue. One says he drives a teal four-door. Another says he drives a green extended cab pickup truck. And that these tips say he goes to Chicago, Miller goes to Chicago to buy the drugs. The last body of information we're dealing with is the tips to Berlin. And I'm going to use, because it's a little bit confusing, and I'm going to try to be consistent in my terminology. We have the confidential informant whose phone it is who's used to phone Berlin. And then we have who the trial court called Mr. Anonymous, all right? So we have Mr. Anonymous uses confidential informant's phone to contact Berlin. Confidential informant has Berlin's phone number because he's dealt with Berlin in the past in terms of being an informant.
It's not clear to me from the facts that the phone used is the known confidential informant's phone. It would appear from the first incident that it is, because the known informant makes the call and tells Berlin, I got somebody who wants to talk to you, or words to that effect. But then when Berlin calls back on that phone, he doesn't get the confidential informant, right? He gets the anonymous.
I think he speaks to the anonymous person. And that it is unclear to me, you know, do these two people maybe live together? What is, you know, how is it that, because the only number that Berlin has is the confidential informant's phone, but yet he's speaking to this anonymous person.
So you're telling me at the second phone call, that you're telling me that the phone number that Berlin uses to call the anonymous person is the phone number of the confidential informant.
That's my reading of the record.
Okay. I did not read the entire record, but from the summary of the facts in the briefs, mm-hmm. It seemed to me that was not clear. And that when Berlin made the phone call on the basis of his phone record, right?
Right.
That he got the anonymous guy.
What I believe to be the case is the second day when the tip doesn't pan out and Berlin calls the number on his phone,
right,
and says, what happened? I think he's speaking with the anonymous.
Yes, I agree with
anonymous.
That.
But I don't know how it is that Mr. Anonymous is also using this phone.
Yes, that's
unclear to me, too.
Yeah. Did Berlin testify that the phone number on his phone pad is the phone number of the confidential informant that he was accustomed to speaking with?
I don't know that he testified that clearly. What he said was that for the first call, is it your belief that Mr. Anonymous got your number from one of those informants, or did he tell you that? No, the informant told me that this person wanted to talk to me. The informant called me. So you had an informant who said, I got somebody else that wants to talk to you. Can I give him your number? Question. Answer, no, I think he just gave him the phone. Question, so then the phone number that you had was your, that sat on your phone, was your informant's number, not Mr. Anonymous's number? Answer, I don't remember.
Okay.
Question, and you didn't note that number down anywhere. I did not. You did not write down the name that you were given as to who Mr. Anonymous was? No, I did not. And you did that deliberately, correct? Yes. So it's a little, I guess it's a little unclear.
Don't know. And it seems to me the question that wasn't asked is, well, if this is a confidential informant, don't you have his number somewhere else and can't you check it against your phone pad, right? That wasn't asked.
No. And it.
So we don't know.
We don't know.
Okay.
And one thing we do know is that the police officer, Berlin, took steps to remove himself, to forget what he knew at one time. We know that.
That in your favor or against your favor?
I don't know what to make of that. I'm not sure. I mean, anonymity is in my favor. The more anonymous the tip, the more unreliable it is.
Right.
I think it's strange what occurred, but I don't have an answer as to what that really means.
Well, I'll tell you why I'm pressing on this, because the concept of anonymity, I mean, that's what this case is about.
Sure.
Three kinds of informants, generally.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Citizen informant. Nobody's claiming he's the citizen informant here. An anonymous informant.
Right.
Or a confidential informant. Someone that the police know and have gotten reliable information from, right?
Correct.
Now, so this is anonymous informant, right? So from my perspective, and I'm sure we can slice it, dice it finer, there are two anonymous informants. Someone whom the police, if they can really know the name, can find him.
They could find him.
Yeah. Doesn't matter if they know the name, but they can find him. They can find him because they can trace the call. They can find him because they have the phone number and can trace the phone number, right? They can find him in one case, I think it was Williams, they could find her because she said, oh, I live
at Tritonia,
across the street. And Babbage is just saying, well, is that a 500 apartment or two bund? You can find her. That's one kind of anonymous call. The other kind of anonymous call is totally anonymous. But here, when you have someone that they can find, and it's arguable they can find him because they got a phone number and a phone that he answers, right? The inference, if he answers it, it's either his phone or he has total access to the phone or has sufficient access, right? But I find Babbage says this in his dissent, which I joined in Williams. Babbage says, it isn't whether the cops can find this anonymous person. The question is, does the anonymous person know that the cops can find him or her? Because the whole concept on anonymity is that if the police know who you are and you give the police misinformation or disinformation, you could be subject to criminal prosecution.
Right. And that, go ahead, I'm sorry.
So that, therefore, that is a test of veracity, right?
Correct. Right.
So, where does this fall? And he got in my categorization of two kinds of anonymous phone calls. Does this guy know that he can be traced and therefore dare to tell the truth or prosecuted?
Right. See, that's where I think that this is different from Williams, in that in Williams, we've got a call, first of all, to a 911 system. And certainly by the time of this case, it's well known that calls to 911 systems are recorded and that a false claim will get you into trouble. What we have here is a couple of layers removed in terms of getting to your question about could the police find him and does this person know that he would be in trouble if he gave misinformation. The call was to Berlin, not to the 911 call. So does the caller know that this isn't going to be recorded? I think there's a good inference that the caller would know that this call to a cell phone, a personally held cell phone, even though it was department issued, is not recorded. Then we have these layers of removal from the actual officer. So I guess I would infer that, sure, maybe a person who calls the police and says and makes something up, is there a risk that that person's going to get into trouble? Sure. But I think it's really removed from the situation of Williams or these other tips where they come in to the police department or to the 911 system. So This individual asked to remain anonymous, used somebody else's phone. I would say he was distancing himself from Berlin in such a way that, you know, his fear of retribution or fear of getting into trouble was pretty minimal. The other reason I think he wasn't that worried about giving misinformation is when this first tip didn't pan out, he didn't call Berlin and say, wait a second, hold the phone. He didn't go anywhere. You know, if he was worried about giving misinformation, he would have called Berlin and said, you know what, there was a change in plan. And this is where I take issue with the Court of Appeals on a couple of facts. One is the Court of Appeals says, well, this was a traceable cell phone. Well, maybe the phone was traceable, but I'm not so sure that Mr. Anonymous could be found. Yeah, maybe Berlin could have leaned on his confidential informant to say, who is this guy? But this isn't, you know, the fact that this is a, quote, traceable cell phone, I think, is of pretty low importance. The other thing is that the Court of Appeals mentioned, well, it's not that unusual that there would be a change in plans, and so the tip, you know, things change. But what's critical here is that this individual didn't call Berlin and say, as I mentioned before, wait a second, it's important that you know this. He didn't go last night after all. I'll call you when I do find out when he left.
Ms. Haskins, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. I'm having some trouble with your argument. And I guess that's basically because I have to think that where Officer Berlin calls back and he gets this tipster a second time, that tipster is going to know, hey, this guy can find me. He just called back. He got me again. He's talking to me again. I'm not somebody who's totally anonymous. Isn't that a reasonable inference to draw that the light goes on? Gee, this guy was able to reach me. Berlin was able to reach me by calling back.
I think as long as though Berlin is calling somebody else's phone, that gives Mr. Anonymous a way out of the situation, gives him a way out of any untruthfulness. That's why I think this extra layer of anonymity is important in this case that doesn't exist in all of the other cases. And, of course, the other removal from, you know, I'm not going to get into trouble, is that this caller, this Mr. Anonymous, is reporting evidently what somebody else said to him. So that gives him yet another layer of insulation. As he's saying, well, all I'm telling you is what somebody else told me. So, you know, if he's reporting what somebody told him, he's not as likely to get into trouble for reporting what maybe would be false information.
Well, let's go back to the central issue, at least as I view it, and that's the issue of reasonable suspicion. Okay, you've got information provided a couple years before by an inmate that this guy, Miller, is selling drugs, okay? You've got three tips, as I understand it, to the Crime Stoppers program. Again, Miller is selling drugs. Now, I agree with the Court of Appeals that both of those tips, if you will, were of low reliability. But you don't separate them out of the totality of the circumstances. Then you go one step further, and you've got these calls back and forth with the person that you're calling the anonymous tipster, okay? Mm-hmm. And at the end, he gives accurate information. He says the guy's going today to Milwaukee. He's going to be driving an Explorer. Here is the license plate on the vehicle. He's going to have to be back here before 11 o'clock, okay? And all of those things pan out. The police go to where the Explorer has been. It's gone. So they monitor the highway, Highway 41, and lo and behold, down Highway 41, about 10:30 at night, before 11 o'clock, but very close, comes Mr. Miller driving the Explorer. Now, you put all of those things together, don't you have reasonable suspicion? You know, way back to Terry, it talks about, did the officers have articulable facts that they could point to that gave them reasonable suspicion? Now, when you put all of that together, how do you come up with no reasonable suspicion?
Well, first of all, I don't think you can use non-credible information as part of the totality of the circumstances. And that's part of the reason why I take issue with the Court of Appeals, is they're saying that there's all this other stuff that happened before. Well, if those aren't facts, then that shouldn't be considered as part of the affirmative information that supports the stop. I mean, in Terry, the police officer himself observed these two individuals acting in a very suspicious manner over, you know, a period of time. Here, this officer, the only thing the officer actually verified was the make, model, the car, basically, and then coming back into Marinette County. We don't know that Mr. Miller drove to Milwaukee and back. We don't know that. We know that the informant said that's where he was going, but we have no way of knowing if that's where he went. We know that when the informant said, we know that the informant said that Miller left work alone. Well, when he's coming back into Marinette, there are two people in the car, and it's late at night, and nobody can see who's who. So the officer actually didn't know if Miller was driving or not, or was in the car at all. I mean, it was Kowalski's car. The officer doesn't know who's in that car. He just knows there are two people in there.
The officer know that the license plate of that car when he stopped him?
Yes. Okay. Yes, the officer knew this is Kowalski's car.
Okay.
And interestingly, nobody's talked to Kowalski in this investigation. You know, the officer didn't call Kowalski and say, you know, what's the deal with your car going out and somebody else driving it or what have you. So I take issue with, you know, I don't think you can just say all this, let's just call it false information and or, you know, zero information. I don't think you can aggregate zero information and then have a tip that, lo and behold, turns out to have something, and call that totality of the circumstances
except
justifying.
The Court of Appeals didn't say that that earlier information, Crime Stoppers and the inmate's tip, that those were proven false. Basically, they said they were not proven false. They weren't proven true,
no,
but they weren't proven false, so that they had low reliability but could be considered under the totality of the circumstances. Doesn't that make sense?
No, it doesn't make sense to me, respectfully, Your Honor. It doesn't make sense to me that you could take information that is not confirmed. And we know that Berlin went to, you know, did some surveillance, not a lot, but did some, and nothing panned out. There wasn't anything about Miller that made them investigate at that point. I mean, there was no attempt to do a controlled buy. There was no, you know, really in-depth surveillance of him that we know of. It was just that when this final tip came in, they thought, well, they'll set up surveillance on the road. I believe that this informant at the end started in a big hole, and the big hole was the tip that was inaccurate, that he didn't call and let Berlin know, wait a second, I was wrong. We add to that, you know, if we look at the specifics of those other tips, which is why I was kind of running through those, we've got different cars that have been identified with Miller. We've got different residences that are identified with him. We've got different sources of drugs. We have different drugs themselves. Justice Prosser, you look like you're trying to ask me a question.
Yes, I am. You seem to put a lot of stock in the fact that the Mr. Anonymous didn't call back right away when the defendant didn't go to Milwaukee or didn't leave. But as I understand it, Berlin did not take any action that night, that is, the night that he was supposed to have left. The next morning at approximately 8 a.m., he drove to the Kowalski residence and noticed there was a black Ford Explorer. Okay. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. Berlin then phoned the anonymous caller, or phoned that phone. How do we know that the anonymous caller wouldn't, if it had been 10 o'clock and there hadn't been any call? But I infer from this that the call from Berlin was relatively early in the morning.
Right. Oh, I see what you're saying. That's true. We don't know if maybe at some point later in the day, if the anonymous informant would have called Berlin and said, oh, he didn't go. We also don't know whether he did go, frankly. I mean, from 11 o'clock at night to 8 in the morning, there's plenty of time to get to from Marinette to Milwaukee and back. And so there's a lot we don't know about that. But, no, I don't know if this informant would have called Berlin and said change in plans. But what I do know is that he didn't by the time Berlin called him.
What I'm dying to know is in the third conversation with the Mr. Anonymous, when Mr. Anonymous calls Berlin, did Berlin take down a phone number from the phone calling him then?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't believe there's testimony in the suppression hearing about that. I don't know.
What about the fact that the confidential informant is the one who supposedly makes the call the first time and then turns it over to the person near him,
right,
Mr. Anonymous? Isn't the confidential informant really vouching for the person?
I'm not sure that he is or she is. I don't know that that would be a fair inference. What I imagine is that there are two people and the informant says, you know, I know this officer and here, if you want to talk to him, here's the phone, but I don't know that he's vouching for him. The other thing is we don't really know very much about the confidential informant. Let's assume he's provided accurate information in the past. I don't know that that's in the record, though. And the other thing that we know, of course, that we began our discussion today with the different types of informants. This isn't like Williams where you've got a concerned citizen saying, you know, I'm watching what I believe to be a crime in the alleyway outside my apartment. For all we know, I mean, we know that, at least under the law, the confidential informants, the reason they are confidential informants is that they mix with criminal element, and that's how they have their information. So, you know, I think it is just as fair to say, well, for all we know, these individuals were involved in drug trafficking themselves and they were getting rid of Miller. You know, that there are any number of reasons why they might want to have Miller picked up.
Thank you, Ms. Askins. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. David H. Perlman, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Perlman.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning, Justices. I submit that what we have here from the state's point of view is a rather strong case that the anonymous tipster gave a solid basis for reasonable suspicion. When you look at the key cases in this area, in Wisconsin, we look at the Williams case. In Wisconsin, we can look at the Sherry case. And, of course, in the federal law, we have the two cases of Florida J.L. and Alabama versus White. If you look at all of those cases, the type of anonymous tipsters that get the greatest credibility are those that show some kind of intimate firsthand knowledge of the incidents they're talking about, and also those whose anonymity are more easily pierced. As the Chief Justice mentioned in her questioning of the petitioner, Justice Babbage, in his dissent in Williams, argued that part of the problem he had in Williams was that the anonymous tipster did not know that he or she could be found. In this case, as Justice Crooks revealed, it is clear that an anonymous tipster knows that they can be found because they were found. The first time there was any alleged defect in what he had tipped, he was reached. Now, what is significant is he was reached by this phone number, and I agree the record is unclear. The way I interpreted the record on this issue is this, that the cell phone belonged to the confidential informant. The confidential informant almost serves as a sponsor here of the tipster. The petitioner says that it creates another layer insulating our anonymous tipster. I would argue it creates a greater portal of access for the police to find this anonymous tipster. So close is the relationship between the anonymous tipster and the confidential informer is that when the officer calls back, it is the anonymous tipster who answers the call. So he has, or she has, great access to the cell phone. And I don't find any real problem in the fact that his original tip proved to be premature when he said that he'd be leaving at 11 p.m. The police arrived at 8 a.m., realized that had not happened. They called him up. He answered. I think it's reasonable to presume, as Justice Prosser suggested, that that was the first time he was aware of the situation. He investigated further, and it was he who recontacted the police. And it was he who told the police, it's going to be at 2 p.m. now that he's going to leave for work. He's going to come back at 11 p.m. I would respectfully submit that drug deals are somewhat dynamic in nature, and the fact that their last-second change of plans are not unreasonable. In fact, the original plan seemed less feasible, leaving at 11 p.m. at night, as opposed to the more practical leaving at 2 p.m. and returning at 11 p.m. I think that this shows that there's a continuous contact between the anonymous tipster, and this contact consistently reveals a firsthand knowledge of the information. Let's look at the first.
Just one second. So concentrating on the tipster, you check the reliability, that is the quality of the information, depending on whether the tipster has firsthand knowledge and whether the anonymity is pierced, right? I mean, that's what you indicated.
Well, yes, any kind of predictive behavior, I think, is a positive check. Well, any kind of exposure.
That goes to the kind of information that's ultimately given.
Right.
But I'm looking at the tipster himself, or Mr. Anonymous. At the
right.
Point. So your view is that the anonymity could be pierced and the tipster knew it. Now, is it your position that it's important, one of the circumstances, that the tipster knew it? Or is it your position that just the fact that the police could pierce it is sufficient?
I think my position was well stated by this court in State v. Williams, that there is no magic formula as to what must be present before a tip can be found reliable or unreliable.
Mm-hmm. Is it more reliable if the tipster knows he can be found?
I think that is one factor in there, but I can never say that any factor in this type of analysis is determinative, mm-hmm. because in every case, I would argue, agree, that there are facts in this case that are weaker than some of the other cases, and there are stronger. I would say that one factor that points to the reliability of the tipster is the fact that he knows he can be contacted by the police. And we don't have to speculate on that fact here. He was contacted by the police.
Okay, now on firsthand knowledge, as I read the materials, he doesn't have firsthand knowledge. He is relying on someone else to give him information. Is that a wrong reading of the record?
I don't know. I think what the record shows is he gives you this information. He does not in any way suggest that he observed it. He doesn't tell us the basis for this information. In that way, he is similar to the tipster in Alabama v. White. He's similar to the tipster in the Sherry case. It is a weakness.
He doesn't say, I was told, or I heard, or
I'm not sure.
Like
I can positively assert that he did not state that he observed this firsthand or that he was part of this deal or anything like that.
All right.
So it's like the tipster in White. It's like the tipster in Cherry. But we don't have a real knowledge of the basis of that information that he has. It would be a positive if we had it from the state's point of view, but we don't. Again, every case has its strengths and has its weaknesses. One of the great strengths of our case, one that the petitioner consistently discounts, is the prior information. This tip did not come to us in a vacuum. It came to us in a vacuum in White. It came to us in a vacuum in Sherry. It came to us in a vacuum in Williams. This case, there is a prior history of people making complaints about the petitioner. The first one comes from the inmate Manneker, and the second are three Crime Stopper tips, but the state's not going to mislead this court saying they're three separate tips. The record strongly suggests that it was the same tipster calling three times. So we can call it two tips in two different ways. Now, while I agree with the Court of Appeals that these tips are of a lower reliability, certainly than the one we have here, and they did not completely pan out because some surveillance was done and nothing materialized, I think it's wrong to say they're completely without any motivation to tell the truth. If you are facing a parole revocation, offering information that is false is not going to help you. If you are a Crime Stopper person and wishing to take advantage of some of the financial aspects of the program, offering wasted tips are not going to help you. So while these tips are low, they are by no means the zero that the petitioner suggests. And they gain strength. The first tip gains strength from the second, and they both gain great strength from the third, which is by far the most substantive and the most reliable.
Counsel, earlier in your comments, you noted that the facts as you view them are, and then you listed the facts. One of the first ones you said was the phone belonged to the confidential informant. As I understand the facts, Berlin used the callback feature on his phone as opposed to having in your phone book on your cell phone that number. Why do you take as a fact, or what in the record supports the fact that the phone belonged to the confidential informant rather than Mr. Anonymous?
That's an excellent point, Your Honor, and I don't think that my opinion at the ultimate merits of this case depends on that issue. It perhaps could have been Mr. Anonymous's phone. As I think about it, as your question raises the issue, because he have a phone number and he goes with the callback feature. That only tells us that the same phone was used twice. It could have been Mr. Anonymous's phone, and he used the confidential informant as kind of a go-between as a way to almost bolster his own credibility. I agree with Justice Prosser's terminology that it's really kind of a vouch situation. Confidential informer, the record is silent as to whether he's reliable in the past, but it's not a quantum leap to presume that he's had some relationship with Deputy Berlin. Would he want to compromise that relationship in this case? But your point is well taken.
I don't know if I was trying to make a point, but
there is a mystery in that.
Because to me, it seems like it's just as viable that the confidential informant used Mr. Anonymous's phone to make the call. But I was wondering if there was something in the record, since you took it as a fact that it belonged to the CI.
I agree with you, and if I had to write another brief, I'd put that in my argument, because I think that is another possibility that the phone is even his, which would, of course, add even more to the ability to pierce that. I think there's no question that the confidential informant was used as a go-between here, but there is nothing, as I see in the record, that could change that particular inference that you drew. I think the reason I jumped to the other conclusion is that first voice you heard was that of the confidential informant in the situation.
Let me ask this. Is there pretty strong suspicion that Mr. Miller is involved with drugs before anything that happened in August?
Well, I can't comment on what I don't know other than those two tips. I have three pieces of information, actually. I have three Crime Stopper tips by the same person saying Miller's doing drugs, in effect. I have Manicor, the inmate, saying Miller's doing drugs. I have a prior record of possession of drug paraphernalia.
I would submit that that certainly creates a milieu of that Miller has a nexus with drug activity. But I cannot say what was going on in the police mind because it's not on the record, and I cannot say whether there was some kind of community feel that Miller was involved with drugs. But certainly when this final tip came, it did not come in a vacuum. I think we can say that clearly.
When the circuit court said, where there's smoke, there's fire, and that's how the circuit court phrased these prior tips.
Yes.
Is the state asking this court to say where there's smoke, there's fire, and that's part of the ambience, part of the entire circumstances?
I think what I would say is that in the end we have a fire, and that makes us look at that earlier smoke as being connected to it.
Well, sometimes you have a fire, but the prior smoke is unconnected to it.
A year later, et cetera.
So you're saying by hindsight.
I'm saying that, yes. I'm saying that now that we have the fire that is so much similar to the smoke we saw earlier, the smoke can now be drawn to be connected more to the fire. I'd go fire first and then look back at the smoke. I'm not asking this court to find a bunch of smoke and deduce fire. There is a fire here already. I'm just asking you that you now look at the smoke, too, and go,
So you don't need the smoke if there's a fire now?
That's a good question, Chief Justice. That's not the case before us, because we did have smoke. But I would submit that while
we have smoke because the circuit court let that evidence in. If it wasn't in, well, there would be no smoke.
True. But the point I'm making here... is that in our particular case, I believe we had both smoke and fire. I would submit that absence of the smoke, while our case is weaker, I still think it is arguable that there'd be enough reasonable suspicion if this tip came by itself, even without the prior tips. You don't have to do that, but with the prior tips, I think that we have, as much as these cases can be, a relatively straightforward application of reasonable suspicion.
This is predictive, right? One of the strengths of the tipster's information that it's predictive and true.
Yes, yes.
So what here is predictive?
Well, what's predictive is the following. First of all, he tells them that he will be going to Milwaukee and then coming back.
That's not corroborated that he's going to Milwaukee.
That is not corroborated he's going to Milwaukee, but he does return at 10:30 p.m. at a time frame and location consistent with the itinerary earlier provided.
Right. And he comes back in the Ford Explorer, right?
Right. I think that's a big factor, Chief. That's somebody else's car. That's pretty inside information. He's not going to be driving his own car. And he even gives a reason why, because the other guy's car is green and too prominent, which, by the way, fits earlier tips that suggest that the man drove a green car. Back to the earlier smoke. So we had the predictive behavior not just of an itinerary, he's returning from Marinette to Milwaukee, but also he will not be driving his own vehicle. He will be driving somebody else's. The vehicle was described in specificity with the license plate and the like, and it arrived at that time.
I agree those two are predictive. What else? For example, the cops don't know that it's Miller who's driving because they do not see him when they stop the car.
No.
And so they can't really count the fact that it was predicted that Miller would drive.
No,
don't you have to look at everything when there's the stop?
Correct, Your Honor, but I do remind the court that we are dealing with a reasonable suspicion analysis, so it's not a big... You see the vehicle, you see it coming at the time frame, you certainly reasonably can suspect that Miller is in that vehicle. Whether it be the driver or the passenger, he'd be in that vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Was the prediction there would be anyone else in the car?
No, as a matter of fact, he said originally... the third tip, that he will be leaving alone. However, I'm not troubled by that because you often can pick people up. It's hard to predict what happened in Milwaukee. But I still feel that the predictive factors that we have here should not be minimalized, that they are real, that they are tangible, and that they are predictive.
You were going to advise police officers, and you do train police officers.
That's correct, Your
Honor. Would you tell them that they should have corroborated by following him or trying to track him in Milwaukee and alerting the Milwaukee police to look at it, or all of that may not be really possible in as large a city as Milwaukee, but some corroboration other than just waiting at the county border might have been a good idea.
Well, you know, Chief Justice, I do think every case along the lines of how would I train the police, and, you know, police never behave perfectly in any particular case.
Most people don't behave otherwise perfectly under any conditions.
We'd be here. I think the police work here is pretty solid. I don't think you can follow them to a Marinette officer with the realities of the distance of Marinette and the resources available to a Marinette officer can go all the way to Milwaukee. What I would suggest if in the future he was asking me for a tutorial based on this case is that perhaps he would more frequently check the parking lot area to confirm that that vehicle never returned. That would be a helpful factor that I would have suggested for him that he could have done. Other than that, he did set up the surveillance at the appropriate time. He did follow up the tip very vigorously the first time. He did recontact the man. The only thing I would tell him in the future is probably I would have gone to Kowalski's parking lot two or three times to confirm the vehicle had not returned. And in that way, it would make it easier for us to understand that he went to Milwaukee and back.
Oh, that it was a great distance. It was a distance away.
It is a far distance away. He can't follow him to Milwaukee. I can't ask him to do that. We're in Marinette. And I think overall, I would say the police work here was solid. And he certainly is a careful officer. The first two tips that he got for after he did his preliminary surveillance, he felt that he did not have enough to bother with Miller. So he shows that he's thinking this through. And finally, when he gets that third tip, he continues to make contact with the gentleman until he reaches the point where he feels he can intervene.
Do we know how long Deputy Berlin was on the Northeast Tri-County Drug Task Force?
I think 8 years. Is that, I think, excuse me, Your Honor, I was going to check. I apologize, Your Honor, all your honors. I don't think I put that in my statement of facts. I know he is a member of it. And I'm sure it was in the record, but I don't recall it.
Well, I'm reading from your opponent's brief.
I don't know if that's a reliable source, but we'll...
I honestly thought it was a very, very good brief. He's on the task force. As such, he investigates drug crimes. It was in that capacity that Nathan Manicor contacted him. It would seem to me a reasonable inference that the confidential informant is someone who has dealt with him in a drug capacity.
Absolutely. I would certainly make that, that they've dealt before. It would make the record, while it doesn't describe the relationship in a straightforward way between the police officer and the confidential informant, there was obviously a relationship there, and I would guess that it would be with drugs, yes. I think, again, here, when you look at this case, the Court of Appeals had it right. You have to look at the totality of the circumstances. You have to look at all the factors that were present. And again, I would say that our case, the weakness is that there is no knowledge of the source of information and any weaknesses inherent with anonymity, and there was no block-by-block surveillance. The strength is the detailed description of the vehicle, the knowledge that it would not be Miller's vehicle, but it would be Kowalski's, the fact that this person did not even contact the police by himself, but had a known confidential informant vouching for him or being by him, the fact that he was easily accessible to the police through the three contacts, all to me in the totality gave the police the reasonable suspicion to make the stop.
I thought your opposing counsel made an extremely interesting point at the outset of the argument that incorrect tips should be negatively valued in the whole scheme of things. How would you respond to that?
Depends what you mean by incorrect. I don't think we have incorrect tips here. In the case of the first two tips, They didn't flesh out, but that doesn't necessarily mean they were incorrect. In the case of the third tip, well, there was incorrect information as to when he was going to leave from Marinette to Milwaukee. There was then the providing of the correct information, and you can draw reasonable inferences that plans change. I think if you have a tip that's proven completely wrong or that is just incorrect, then it shouldn't be part of the analysis. But I don't think we had any incorrect tips here. We had weaker tip, stronger tip.
Mr. Perlman, as I understand the United States, the Supreme Court case, which they considered close, I always figure once the court says something, it becomes the middle, and then it pans out from there, even if it said close. And then we get to the next one, and the next one, and the next one, until it falls apart. And the point of this emphasis on the tip is, on the one hand, we know, or I think we know, that in many instances, the reason that somebody is caught is because the police are given a tip. Unlike NCIS, of great lab work and forensic work, that makes for good TV. It's one of my favorite programs, but that's not real life, as I understand real life. So it's very important that if we're going to have reasonable suspicion, we recognize we're going to have to rely on tips, because that's where, I don't want to say most, but many people might say most, is of the information to come. And we don't want to stifle good police work. We don't want to stifle catching criminals, right?
Correct.
Okay. That's one policy. The other policy, which is set forth in the United States Supreme Court in the majority opinions and in the minority opinions, is that it becomes very easy for somebody, especially an anonymous person who doesn't think they're going to get caught, to harass someone they don't like, or for whatever reason, and call the cops and have the cops make unconstitutional stops and searches and seizures, right? So that's the balance. And the way the courts have balanced this is to look at the totality of the circumstances, right?
Yes.
And the problem is we don't see the cases where there's no fire, where the cop stops somebody on the tip and it's clean, no weapon, no drugs, whatever, no contraband. We only see the cases where they found something and there's fire. And by going backwards from the fire to the tips, you know, it all looks quite, could look quite reasonable under the totality. So where does it stop? That's what bothers me.
Chief, I guess what you're saying, what I'm hearing you're saying is, let's just take a situation where we have the two prior tips here and nothing else. And he stops Miller's vehicle and finds nothing. The odds are that would not ever be brought to anybody's attention. It would be staying in-house. There would be some apology maybe at best, and we would move on. And the best that we can do, Your Honor, with dealing with that issue, with the totality of the circumstances and with the whole murkiness of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, is to go case by case and try to ensure as much as possible that that's not what is occurring here.
I've changed my question. In this case, what would you eliminate to reach another result? In other words, if the state didn't have what factor in this case, what piece of evidence would it mean the state would lose?
I thought about that question myself, and here's what I came up with. If there had been no further contact between the police and our tipster after the first tip did not pan out, and at 10:30 p.m., they're traveling on Highway 41, and they see that vehicle, and they make the stop, that is a stop I could not defend. So the factor there would be that there wasn't that continuous contact with explanation.
Okay. Well, so tell me why that's the important one. Is it because the guy's not really anonymous and he knows he's not anonymous?
Well, we don't know whether or not now we'd be in mystery to know whether he's anonymous or not, because we wouldn't have that return phone call by the police officer. We wouldn't know if this person has any kind of firsthand knowledge, because he was way off and never gave a tip that proven to be good. So I think in these circumstances, if there had been a situation where the police arrived at 8 a.m., saw the vehicle there, said, whatever, and then saw the vehicle at 10:30 p.m. and made a stop, that would be a major problem.
Suppose that instead of Berlin calling the tipster called Berlin and gave the same information. Would the state's case be as strong?
Stronger. Stronger. I'll admit that. Stronger.
Why?
Well, this is what the petitioner was getting at in her comments, and which I think it was Justice Prosser tried to explain. Maybe there was a logical explanation for it. What would make it stronger is this tipster, it would show just dramatic firsthand knowledge that he's calling as the plans get changed and he's keeping you up to date every second. So I think the case would be stronger if he had made a phone call. I think there's a lot of reasons why he didn't make the phone call, the most likely being he didn't know. But if I had that, the case would be stronger. Mm-hmm. But I think my case is strong enough.
On page 131 of the appendix in the blue brief, it says, Smith says, about reasonable suspicion. Smith says no. Court says, why not? Smith, because the information they got is third hand. Court says, we don't know that. Smith, we know that. The court, no, we don't. Ms. Smith. We know that because Berlin put in his report, and he told us today that's accurate. He got this information from Mr. Anonymous, who got it from somebody else. And then the court goes on to see who the somebody else is.
I'm not, it would be, again, stronger if it was a firsthand observation, but I don't think that how he got the information, be it firsthand or secondhand, doesn't change the fact that there was predictive qualities of his information that proved to be true. Doesn't change the fact that we had those prior tips that are consistent with this. Doesn't change the fact that the reasonable suspicion was there for the officers at the time they made the stop.
Any further questions?
Thank
Hearing
you, Justice.
None. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Perlman.
Let me provide the court with some record sites just to ease review of the record. The hearsay that I referred to is at the bottom of page 50 of the suppression transcript and the top of page 51, where the questioner asks Berlin, the anonymous caller, according to your report, says somebody told him right that Miller and Kowalski were going to Milwaukee. Yes. Question. Okay, so somebody's telling this anonymous caller that Kowalski and Miller were going to Milwaukee. Answer, somebody must have. Question. So this is not firsthand information from the anonymous caller. Somebody's telling you these things. Answer, I'm not sure. He didn't say how he got it, where he got it, who he got it from. And then there's some questions about the report. Page 64 of the transcript talks about the exchanging of the phone between the informant and the tipster. And at page 4 of the transcript, Deputy Berlin has been with the Marinette County task force for the last several years. Now, there was a suggestion, I think, that we go to the fire at the end of this this stop, and we have the fire at that point, and that sort of justifies or explains the smoke that's come before. And since we're looking at what the end result is, normally we don't look to well, what did the police find? That's not relevant. We look at what the police knew when the police stopped him. But what did they find in this case is also interesting to me, at least, because what they found was not OxyContin and heroin. What they found was some marijuana and some cocaine. And Mr. Miller did not have $5,000 to $10,000 on him that he didn't spend on the OxyContin and the heroin. He had $596. So, you know, if we're looking at the end result to go, you know, back in time, I think those facts are also worth considering. What troubles me about this case is that there's the suggestion, and you know, we do, there's a good reason why there's the expression where there's smoke, there's fire. But what troubles me is that this isn't a colloquialism. This is the Fourth Amendment in action. And my concern is that rumors repeated, somehow have assumed the mantle of reliability. And I think, you know, as people, it's easy to fall into a belief that just because something is repeated many times, it must be true. And I think it's important to resist that temptation in this case and to say, until we know something, it's not a specific and articulable fact. And to suppress the evidence in this case would not mean that the police hands were tied. What it might mean, though, is rather than stop that car, maybe the police follow that car, see where Mr. Miller is going. Maybe the police try to do a controlled buy if he's come back from Milwaukee with all these drugs. Maybe the police do a knock and talk at his home after he's home. So, you know, I think the state is justifiably trying to say, well, the police work was good enough here, but it sure could have been a whole lot better. And I think that if it had been a whole lot better, if the police had, for example, done a buy, again, we would not be here. So my, you know, again, I just want to emphasize that both the Court of Appeals seem to be saying, geez, we've got a lot of smoke, we've got a lot of talk, therefore it must be true. And I am asking the court to resist that and to say, no, we require facts.
Ms. Anskin, what kind of opinion would you have the court write? Just outline it for me.
Well, I would ask the court to specifically address that last paragraph or the end of the, excuse me.
You're talking about the Court of Appeals?
The end of the Court of Appeals decision. And talk about and say that we will not require the defendant to disprove tips that are not proved false. You know, that language about
are you starting at
moreover, although the prior tips about Miller's involvement in drug dealing were not verified, they had not been proved false. I would ask the court to say that that's not part of our analysis. I would ask the court to say that the record does not support the Court of Appeals' conclusion that the cell phone was a traceable cell phone, and therefore that's an important fact. Because, of course, it's not the phone, it's the person. I would ask that the court firmly state that, or say that the Court of Appeals was wrong when it says, although, excuse me, the informant had given different information the day before about when the drug buying trip was to occur, we see nothing inherently inconsistent or unreliable about the informant reporting a change in plans. What I would like this to see the court do is say negative information doesn't become positive by some reframing in the court's mind. You know, I have the sense from what the state was saying that, well, drug deals are inherently fluid situations, so anything goes. Well, anything doesn't go. It's got to be facts, and if the informant has inside knowledge, the informant's going to know what's going on.
Thank you, counsel. Any questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
None. I want to thank Ms. Askins and thank Mr. Perlman for their excellent briefs and their excellent arguments today on yet another reasonable suspicion case in different facts and a different framework. That concludes our hearing on 10-AP-557-CR, State versus Joseph C. Miller. Our students may leave. The Lakeland Union High School students may leave if they wish. We are awaiting the arrival of the Whitefish Bay High School students.